You are listening to Todd Talks from the Truett Church Network. Thank you for listening, and we hope you enjoy.
Welcome to Todd Talks, where my guest today is Dr. Emily Smith. Emily is an assistant professor in the Department of Emergency Medicine and Surgery at Duke University and at the Duke Global Health Institute. She is also the author of The Science of the Good Samaritan, the volume that will occupy much of our conversation this morning. Emily, welcome to Todd Talks. Thank you so much for taking the time to visit with us today.
Thank you for having me. It's also really fun chatting with people that I know in real life. I mean, all the podcasts have been fun because you make new friends, but old friends are great to talk to. So thank you.
Yeah, it's the old adage, it's tough to make old friends or you can't make old friends. So appreciative of your friendship and of your scholarship. And I thought that it might be interesting for our listeners, Emily, to learn how is it that you became interested in being a scientist in the first place?
Yeah, I love that question. And I think I fell into it just because I've always loved science and math. I've just been a nerdy person my entire life. I've loved school. I remember one of my first dreams. You know where they ask you when you're in elementary school, what do you want to be? And I wanted to be either a singer like Sandy Patty. So for you Christian types, I mean, I wrote her a letter when I was 11, I think. Bless it. But I also wanted to be a missionary because I loved science, but I also just loved the world. It's one of my earliest memories. And I thought the only way to do that was through medical school because I hadn't really seen anything other than missionaries being doctors and nurses and dentists. So fast forward to going to undergrad, I was pre-med because again, what else was I going to do except that, which was still fine. But then I went on my first mission trip with the Mercy Ship to Honduras. And there I saw things that I had been reading about, you know, my whole life in person. And it changed me in a couple of ways. I grew up in the church. My parents were worship leaders in a charismatic church. And so we were the home that hosted the missionaries. And these great missionaries would just answer all of my questions at 8 or 9 years old. And a lot of them were in the medical field. So when I went to Honduras, I noticed that I was asking questions that were different than medical school type questions. Like I was interested in treating the individuals that were coming for care, but I was asking questions about poverty and population problems. You know, why is this group affected more than the other? And I didn't know it at the time, but that was epi. So I got married, got into medical school, but his first job in the church, married a pastor, was all the way across the country. So I had a gap year. And like all good nerds in a gap year, let's just get another degree to increase. What else am I going to do, right? And it would help medical school. And so I did it in public health thinking that would look really good on a resume, honestly. But day one of epidemiology, my professor got up and he said, you know, epidemiology is it's the distribution and determinants of disease. So what makes a disease spread and who is at risk? And that hit me of, oh, those are the questions that I just intrinsically ask about, like population level. So I just switched gears, didn't go to med school, got a PhD in epi, and the rest is history.
Well, and who would have imagined that that kind of preparation would have led you to be able to respond to the pandemic that swept our world? So this leads me really to the book, because it, at least in part, it was spawned by the pandemic. But let me not put words in your mouth. Emily, share with our audience why it is you wrote the book in the first place. I mean, obviously, books just don't write themselves, and something compels an author to write. What was it?
Well, I've always wanted to write a book. I'm an Anna Green Gables fan. since I was little. So I've had that in the, you know, little nugget in the back for a while. But it really came out of, like you said, the pandemic. You know, epidemiology is the field of looking at who is at risk of some sort of disease and then trying to alleviate that. And so when we are trained to look for pandemics and epidemics and risk and, you know, model what could or couldn't happen. So when we started seeing what was happening in Wuhan, we looked up for sure. I mean, Ebola has happened before, SARS has happened, and those are scary and awful indeed. But what was happening was, looked a little different. You know, when someone is sick with Ebola, you know when they're sick. And it's a horrific disease. But this thing in Wuhan looked like it was different. Is it airborne? Does it spread before somebody knows that they're sick? So I was actually at a conference in Houston giving a talk, and we were just hearing about it. So I was getting a lot of questions about, you know, should we be scared? What does flatten the curve mean? And those questions. So I started that Facebook page really for my friends and real life neighbors and my mom, with no plans to go viral at all. Did not start out that way for sure. And so I started speaking about this is what flatten the curve means, but also from an equity standpoint, because in my day job, I do a lot of health equity work for children in the intersection of poverty and food insecurity, mainly in Africa. And so I knew that if this thing struck already impoverished communities or marginalized communities because of healthcare access, it would get really scary. And so the impact would not be equal, which is why it would be an inequity. So I started speaking about the pandemic too from a Christian standpoint. One, because I'm a pastor's wife. And so I was trying to give really practical tips to pastors of don't come in your buildings yet. Mask when you go in. What about choirs? I mean, just all those intricacies that I knew they were asking just because we were living that life too. But also from a Christian perspective of when the pandemic became weirdly political and divisive, it was mind-boggling to me. And so my first viral post was on wearing a mask out of faith. And that was a juxtaposition against, you know, people saying, I'm going to have faith, not fear. And I was like, wait a minute, when you look in Galatians 5, wearing a mask is full of faith and also full of love for our neighbors. So all that to say, January 6th, when the Capitol riot happened, that I wrote a post on the intersection of politics, power, privilege, and in this pandemic. And that one certainly went viral for good and bad reasons. Or good and bad repercussions of it. But I saw the group on my Facebook page, and by this point, there were 80,000 people reaching, you know, 3 to 4 million people a month, a divide in the Christian group, because I had certainly non-Christians and other faith leaders in there. But the Christian group either went really hard turn towards, we are not going to wear a mask, like just and everything that meant. But then this other group went, I've never seen racial inequities like we did when George Floyd was murdered, or I've never seen something like the Capitol riot happen. What is next? So the book is to that group.
Yeah. Wow. So when we think about the parable of the Good Samaritan recorded in Luke's gospel, most of us would not necessarily think about science. And when we think about science, we would not necessarily think about the Good Samaritan. So what an intriguing title, The Science of the Good Samaritan. Unpack it for us.
Yeah, on the Jeopardy, if you're ever on Jeopardy or on the at the Thanksgiving table and you want to impress people, just say epidemiology because it's seven syllables. But then the proper definition is that it's the distribution and determinants of disease, like I've already said. But for me, the more work that I do in that field with the inequity problem, it is a science of quantifying who is at risk and then choosing not to walk by. And day one of Epi, that story I told you with my great professor in my master's program, I nearly started crying in class because it just hit me that this is the science of the Good Samaritan. It's my job to quantify populations and countries and then choose not to walk by. So that story really has, you know, such a depth for me. And certainly in the pandemic, you know, I named my Facebook page Friendly Neighbor Epidemiologist, not from Spider-Man, but from this story of the science of the Good Samaritan. Let's not walk by, you know, whatever these communities are in need.
So when the scribe asked the question, who is my neighbor? He may have asked it theoretically or in an attempt to distance himself from the neighbor, right? But obviously the way that the parable unfurls is Jesus makes it clear that the neighbor is the one in need, even if that neighbor is for you ostensibly outsider.
Right. And that's, you know, most of us who have grown in the church have heard that story, I don't know how many times. And so it kind of becomes where you skip over it in the 1 year Bible reading plan, or you skim. When I really started reading it, though, I noticed a few things. And one was what you're talking about, the two questions in the story. And they're sneakily similar to each other, but the postures are different. You know, that man who said, who is my neighbor? And we don't, like you said, we don't know his voice inflection. But I wonder if he was saying, what's good enough to be good enough? You know, how much money do I need to give? Or how many times do I need to volunteer at a food pantry? And being good Jesus, he doesn't answer the question. He answers it with a story and then a question. But he tells that story of the Good Samaritan, of two people of power and privilege walk by this man in need. And someone, a Samaritan, finally stops. But not, this is what I missed as a kid. Not only does he stop, he bandages the man up, takes him to a place to recover, and then he pays for all of it. And that part makes me teary. I don't know how many times I've said this story, but I tear up every time, because this issue of holistic love and neighboring involves some extravagant things that take time and take some money. There's a poverty issue there as well. I think we taking care of that is biblical for sure. But then he turns to the man, Jesus did, and said, now who was the neighbor? And so there's a difference between what is good enough to be good enough versus living a life of neighboring, like being a neighbor where it just oozes out of you. And I think to get that in you, in your heart, takes a lot of work, and it's much harder than a 10-step plan. So the first part of the book is about that heart issue.
Yeah, let's pivot to the book in just a minute. But it is interesting, isn't it, that the lawyer can't even say the name Samaritan, can he?
That's right. Yeah.
The one who had mercy. So the way the story unfurls is it's the outsider that has compassion on the insider. And so there's so much irony and so much surprise in that little parable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just rich with not only the theology and the irony, but I think the science when you get to the money aspect and the taking care of the person. Yeah.
So let's talk a bit about the book. And here's what I'd love to do. Let's pretend for a minute, Emily, that you are a tour guide. And if you were to have a group and you were taking the group on a tour of your book, take off. Take us with you. What does it look like? What we find?
Well, I'll pretend like I'm a tour guide in the Museum of Art, the Met, because that's my favorite. I sectioned the book into three sections: centering, cost, and courage. All had to start with a C because I'm a good Baptist preacher's wife, right?
Alliteration. It's the order of the day.
I've been in church a long time. And the first part on centering is like what I mentioned before. It's that, how do we center our hearts on who Jesus centered on? Because if you read what Jesus did, I mean, when he stops entire crowds for women who were bleeding and had spent all of their money on medical care, and he stops, he centers on her. He centers little children. He centers lepers and beggars. So he's got his center that's different than being centered on maybe power and privilege of the day. Power and privilege in and of itself is not wrong. It's just how that is wielded and used. And Jesus kind of flipped those concepts on their head. So that centering part is how do we do that? And I separated the chapters into topics that I found were not only divisive during the pandemic, but more of, I've never heard of that before. So I've got, you know, structural violence and systemic racism, inequity, solidarity. Those words, when I would write about it, got some pretty disjointed repercussions, good and bad, on those. And so I could tell people didn't quite understand what structural violence meant. So I wanted to talk about that because I think if we get it correctly, we center correctly. The next section is cost. It's the smallest section of the book. It's two chapters. I read the audiobook. So if you listen to that, you will notice those two chapters feel like the paragraphs aren't formed very well. I felt like I was stammering. And, you know, as many times as you write and edit, I still could not get it clean. And I don't think it's supposed to. So those chapters are very more, they're personal on what it cost me and my family to really act like the Good Samaritan for, you know, well, during the pandemic. And that included some awful threats at the house and against my children. And I got very sick. And a lot of the pushback and threats and harassment were from either people I knew or people in churches. So it just took me aback where finally my body just said no more and I got very sick. And so I wanted to honor that cost, not in a tell-all way, but in a way that, you know, it costs something to follow Jesus. And I wanted people to be a little more prepared than what I was. That last part is courage. Because I have found, thank goodness I am better, took 18 months and I'm still recovering. You know, in many ways, I will probably always still be recovering. But I have also found that I have courage now that I didn't even know was in me to begin with. Had I known what we were going to have to do, what I was going to have to do, I probably wouldn't have done it, which is why I probably didn't know. God might be sneaky like that, but I have found more courage to be me. And so I think living a life of neighboring helps people step into the fullness of who they are as like heaven on earth type people. So that's, that section is all about how do we do that? And it, some of it is practical, but some of it is more like, we need to talk about climate change and food insecurity. We need to talk about inequities when it comes to healthcare. I've got a story in there about Dr. Khan that if we have time, I can talk about, but that one by far seemed to resonate with people on how do we value who gets what in life. And so that's what the courage part's about.
Well, let's talk about perhaps Dr. Khan or others, because I'm interested, Emily. The book has now been out since October the 24th of 2023. So we're visiting a couple of months after it's, quote, dropped. What are you hearing? I mean, obviously, you've talked to a lot of folks just like me on podcasts. You've also had an opportunity by now to probably see some reviews coming through. Kudos to our friends at Zondervan, who I think did a wonderful job not only in publishing but also promoting the volume. So, what are you hearing? How's it going as you're doing your quote book tours?
Oh well, it is surprisingly going so well, and I say surprisingly because it's, I mean, it's your first book, so I just had no barometer on what it could or couldn't be, and also, the things that are in there can be seen as provocative if you don't have an open heart. Like talking about systemic racism can get some people really riled up. So there's been a little bit of that, but by and large, it's been so great. And you know what I have loved the most is pastors emailing and saying, you, like they can use my book as a segue to have these hard conversations so they don't have to do it from the pulpit. Because I really try to tell you know, these concepts in both personal stories, but also in a way that can be understood and, you know, challenging, but not threatening. So I have loved that. And we just released a guide for book clubs or Bible studies or Sunday schools if they want to use that too.
Oh, well, it's heartening to hear that it's going so well. And one of the things that you've just said is you want to make it actionable.
Right.
One of the things I really appreciated in reading the book myself is as you come to a close, you offer an appendix. And this appendix is fascinating, but it's actually seeking to help people like me, readers of the book, operationalize the concepts in the book. That is, how can we go about living a life of neighboring? Would you mind, Emily, to just kind of summarize the appendix? Maybe this can be both a trailer and a teaser for those who've not yet read.
Yes, and the appendix was fun to do. I tend to be chatty. I think everybody kind of knows that by now. So the appendix was another way to put what I want in. In the book, one of them is a list of my top 10-ish books because I could not get it down to 10. So I think there's 14 in there. And that, I think reading for me has been one of the biggest ways to live a life of neighboring because you hear other people's stories. So I give my top 10 books of what to do there. But then the other appendix is how do you do this on a normal Tuesday when you're a mom with two kids and you're at home, or you're a teacher, or you're, you know, just name whatever phase of life you're in. Cause we have two kids. I mean, I understand that concept that we all just can't go overseas all the time. So one of them, and I tried to also make it pretty specific to my demographic. So people with children and just what we've done. And so we got a map, put it on the fridge of the world. And in my work, I work at the Global Health Institute. So I just hear, you know, names of countries and places and people, and I'll come and we'll find it on the map with the kids and, you know, put a star on it or something. But I think anytime you can get the kids involved interactively, I think that does something in their hearts to root neighboring in it. Another is just get a sticky notepad. And if you hear on the news or in conversation with somebody, a new word, you know, in a different language or something you didn't know about Australia, write it on a sticky note and then share it with your kids at the dinner table. So those are some pretty practical tools. The other two are reading, of course, and then listening. I think listening is as powerful as reading to learn other people's stories as well.
Thank you. Those are things that are portable and practical. Emily, one of the things that stood out to me as I read the book is on the other side of the maelstrom, you decided to step away some from social media. And you've said that you now are far more selective in your engagement. Maybe this can be something that you wouldn't mind to reflect upon a minute, because I know that all of us struggle with a digital deluge. We find ourselves overwhelmed by information. So how have you gone about discerning, deciding what you're going to engage and what you're going to say, what do you think?
Yeah. I've gotten much better at going, nope. Now, my personality is not one to do that, but I've gotten a lot better at it. You know, with my body falling apart and then the harassment being as horrific, I just had to get off of everything. And I did that for about a year and I still haven't gone back on Facebook. It's been 2.5 years, I guess, at this point. But I also put hard parameters around anything else online. So it is hard to do that. And if we're not careful, we can drift into it becoming very, very normative and, you know, checking that, getting that dopamine hit all the time. So I would just encourage people, if you're thinking about it, it has been one of the best decisions to get off, because I think it quiets the storm of just thoughts. And then you can kind of hear yourself and get that discernment on not only what the Lord wants, but some very selective, trusted voices and news and wisdom. You know, there's only a handful that I listen to or that I read now. And I just think I'm quieter. I think that I am more calmer and happier about it because my brain has some space to think.
Well, that may serve as a challenge that will take some courage and create some cost as yes. we for other things, perhaps. So thank you for that. So Emily, you may want to share something else, but I have one other question for you. And, you know, here I am being greedy. So I'm wondering on what are you presently working? And in addition to the spate of articles that you are busy about researching that will ultimately find life in medical journals, be it in print or online or perhaps both, do you have another book in mind yet? Would you like to write another book?
I would love to write another book. It wasn't the horror stories that I've heard about writing a book. It was not my experience, probably because I've been thinking about this for years and years and years. So once you finally get it, you know, to write it out, it just comes out. I would love to write a book. We actually had to cut 15, 20,000 words of this one because I have a lot to say, I guess, or a lot of stories, too chatty. And what I'm working on right now, I mean, we'll see what that book looks like. You know, is it for kiddos on how to neighbor? Is it for moms? Is it more sciencey or is it more devotionally? I don't know. I'm waiting to see what bubbles up. In my professional work, we are doing, and you read about that a lot in the book, but we're doing some really great work on poverty and trying to answer the question of how do we make sure families can get to healthcare and it not bankrupt them? Because we see that all of my work, Somaliland, Burundi, Tanzania, that is the key factor. So we're doing some modeling and working with some key players on how could we help those families then? And I just love it. I pinch myself on being able to do something like that in this world. It's pretty dreamy.
Well, Emily, I'm wondering, Dr. Smith, do you have anything else for that you might want to share with those that might join us in our audience? Do you have a last word?
I just hope that it can. This book can be challenging, but not yelling, but shake some tables a little bit. You know, where that need to be shaken, but in a way where you can have conversations when needed. I think that's my biggest hope, that it would give people courage to be neighbors, but also help pastors and their churches do that. Because there are just so many great pastors out there with hearts of gold wanting to do this and want their congregations to do this. And I hope this can help, you know, be a helpful resource for that.
Emily, thank you for writing this book, The Science of the Good Samaritan. And also thank you for this conversation, which has been delightful and life-giving. Blessings on you and your continued work, not only at Duke, but your continued writing ministry. And we're grateful for it. We've been enriched by it. Thank you.
Thank you for having me. This has been really nice to see you again.
Be with you. Thank you for joining Todd Talks. Stay tuned. We'll talk again.